Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 2nd of June. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
And I'm Charles Archer.
Yeah, nearly halfway through the year. Just where is this time going? I mean, it's can you believe we're 5 months in, nearly into the midway point of the year? How's things going with you guys?
Yeah, not too bad. It's been a really good year. Finally, we're getting a bit of sentiment, a bit of happiness back in the market, and we're seeing a bit of sunshine in the UK as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's have a look at some of the... I mean, it's been what a week for news. Firstly, we had Rishi Sunak announcing that if the Conservative, and I think there's a big if on that one, if the Conservative Party is re-elected in the upcoming July the 4th election, 18-year-olds in the UK will be required to perform mandatory national service. This initiative is aimed at providing young people with opportunities they deserve and fostering unity in society. Under the plan, young individuals can choose between a full-time placement in the armed forces for 12 months or volunteering one weekend a month for a year in their community. Sunak emphasised that this measure is crucial in an increasingly uncertain world. What do you make of that? What, you know, 2 days before that, he dismissed national service, and then 2 days later, when the election was announced, he's changed on that.
Well, it's red meat to be older voters, and almost all of whom have never done national service. But I just, in terms of enforcing it, they've already said they're not going to directly punish 18-year-olds for not taking part. And they've talked about punishing parents for something their adult child has chosen not to do, which is legally nonsense. But, you know, just as a general rule, I mean, you know, when I was 18, I was working full time, and I needed the money to pay the bills. Couldn't take a weekend off a month. I'm sorry. The time to go do unpaid service, which is, you know, ridiculous. And even, you know, even if you don't have a job, what if you have caring responsibilities? What if you are doing some kind of, I don't know, okay, you want to go on a gap year, for example, between 18 and 19, which is extremely common. Oh, I'm sorry, you have to fly back to the UK once a month to do your national service. That's not going to happen either. It's just the most, it drives me, like the concept of national service, you know, potentially might be a good idea. But it's just a rushed, botched policy put out to try and get some votes back, and it's not going to work, and they're going to get eradicated in the election that can't come soon enough. But having said that,
do you think it'll do these Gen Zers or Gen Xers good to actually see what it's like for a bit of discipline and kind of hard work?
Well, I don't know. I mean, you had the Yes Minister poll, you know, even today. I'm not sure you've ever seen the clip where most people are both, you know, for and opposed to national service. I think that the general idea is, you know, it'll be good to see you get a little bit of work. I mean, I'm looking, you know, if you're turning 18 now in this country, you're looking down the barrel of, okay, well, I'll never be able to buy a house because the house prices are too high. If I want to go to university, I have to pay student loans for 40 years at 9% of my income. Anything I earn over 50 grand is going to be taxed at 51% for my entire life. There won't be a state pension when I retire. The society of fabric is kind of collapsing. I'm not being, you know, I sound kind of negative, but actually, what are you giving to 18-year-olds in return for the national service? They come out of it into a country that doesn't work for them. So I'm not sure why we should want, you know, that if, for example, you came out of national service into a functioning economy with a great jobs market, where there's loads of opportunity and buying a house and starting a family was all affordable, then maybe that's realistic. But as it is, the state doesn't give you anything worth having. And anything you do try to have, they tax you about 50%. So, I'm very against it, personally. But then at the same time, maybe it would be good to get some kind of social cohesion. I just don't think that's the way forward, at least not in its current form.
Yeah. Kev, what about in Egypt? Is national service a thing over there?
Yeah, you have national service every first son has to go and do national service.
Yeah.
As long as there are two boys in the family. So in other words, if there's only one boy in the family, they will not do national service. Two boys in the family, they will do national service. But there are sorts of exemptions. So if your father is over 60 years of age, by the time you come to be in national service, you don't have to do it. If your father is not Egyptian, you don't have to do it. So there are different scenarios. But I think on an annual basis now, there are over a million conscriptees, if you like, every year.
Yeah.
So the Egyptian army is, I think, including conscripts, many millions every year.
Yeah. Okay. And if they don't do it, from what I can gather, it's not going to be, you know, punishable with a prison sentence, but the parents will be the ones who pick up the fine.
But how can you fine parents for something an adult child hasn't? It's kind of the equivalent, it's... a really extreme equivalent. Say an 18-year-old goes and murders somebody. Do their parents go to prison? I mean, arguably, maybe in some, you know, in some society, they should be punished for raising a terrible person. But actually, no, once you reach the age of majority, that's it. Now, I mean, the other thing is funding, right? I mean, they were talking about like £2.5 billion to fund this, which is very clearly an underestimation. £2.5 billion in this country, you know, in a country where there's, I could really a list of about 1,000 things we could spend £2.5 billion on, right? That would massively improve the country more. And again, you know, the thing, I'm not actually inherently opposed to the concept of national service of some kind, but I do think that if you were going to implement that kind of policy in this country in 2024 or 2025, you want to spend more than 3 minutes coming up with a plan, right? It's as simple as that. You want to say, what can we do that actually is going to be beneficial to 18-year-olds and society as a whole? And what are they going to get out of it? Because I highly doubt, for example, if you don't do the army thing and you do like the 1 weekend a month, how much is that actually going to help you or society? Especially when it's 18-year-olds who definitely aren't going to want to do it.
Absolutely. Did you see him, by the way, this week? Because he visited the, you know, the Drew Arms Community Pub in Exeter. He's down your way. You didn't bump into him.
I didn't bump into him. If I had, I mean, he probably would have ripped him apart. I mean,
would you?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, it's like it's both sides, and like both our all our politicians are just completely terrible, right? I mean, like Labour, just you know, they're going to get a big majority, but they're just awful. And I think, you know, I know it's controversial, but the VAT on the private schools thing. I think that's the one that gets my goat. And it's not really about, like, I understand, if private schools are bad, just ban them, right? But trying to milk them for money is just not a great idea for a variety of reasons. But the thing that really gets me is hypocrisy. Because Keir Starmer is going, look, okay, regardless of whether he went to private school or not, and you're irrelevant, he's saying that he sends his children, they all send their children to state schools. But they're not really state schools, because in order to go to that state school, you have to own a house that's worth £2.5 million next door to it. So you're not paying fees, but you bought a £2.5 million house. And therefore, the children and the kind of funding that school gets is very different to like some of the schools that you might get out in the sticks or in some bits of London or Birmingham. So it kind of irritates me that you have this kind of like, this policy won't raise any more money than what it costs as children move into the state sector. And it's just politics and envy. So I feel that one thing has like got me going, okay, so I thought Labour had kind of like, maybe they'll be good for the country. I think they'll definitely be better than the disaster we've got now. But it's not going to be a panacea. What's going to happen is they're going to get in. Everything will feel great for about 3 weeks, and then it will just be as bad as it was before.
Yeah. What does that policy say about what Labour want to transmit to its main voters?
Yeah.
It says we're going to stick it to the ones that have got some money. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. In a not too aggressive manner, and the vast majority of people going, yeah, what, they don't pay that on their fees? You know, it's like tough. You know, if you can afford to send your child to a public or a private school, then by goodness, it's a service. You should be paying that. End of story.
But I mean, that's a fair argument to make. But if you go to Germany, you get a tax credit. If you send your children to private school, you get given money by the government for not taking the state place. But I mean, for me, it's not really so much like what people think, so much as we're already in a situation in this country where if you're wealthy, but if you're a high earner but not wealthy yet, and then you get most of your money from working, like I do, you're already taxed so much. And then if you want to send your children to private school, that's a huge expense on top of that. And people going, oh, well, you know what, just pay the VAT and, you know, it's a service and whatever else. It's like, no, what will actually happen is that high earners will leave the country, which they're already
absolutely. And there will be a lot of children actually affected by this. People, I agree with what Kev's saying, that, you know, if you can afford the 20,000 a year, you can afford an extra 2,000 or 4,000 on top of that. Ultimately, some will already be stretched that are pushing them, you know what I mean? And they will definitely not. And there'll probably be about 20% that will pull out for sure.
Well, I mean, I made a secret, I went to private school, but I benefited from a scholarship and from bursaries.
Yeah.
And my fear as well, you know, again, you know, like, it's a controversial thing. If they're bad private schools, then do what the Scandinavia is, just ban them all, right? But if you're going to keep them, they need to be retainable. And my concern is that those financial policies that I benefited from, those will be the first things that are going to go. So anybody who, you know, might be able to afford it with some kind of financial support, that support will get withdrawn to stop the fees from actually rising. That's what will happen, and it's going to be awful. And then, you know, send kids as well. There's a lot of children with special educational needs in the private system that the state sector can't care for, Yeah, I don't know. But then at the same time, I understand that 97% of the country goes to state school, and my own children are in state school in the primary sector at the moment. I'm hoping to send them private from poor secondary.
Yep.
So I get that you need to fund the state schools properly, but I don't think that this is going to help.
No. Okay. Let's move across the pond, because there was some news out on late Thursday, early Friday morning. Over in New York, Donald Trump convicted on 34 felony charges. He responded with defiance, calling the trial rigged and a disgrace. Well, no surprise there. And after the verdict, Trump posted, I don't know if you saw the video, but it was put out on Truth Social, urging his supporters to join his fight for America, promising to demolish the deep state and expel globalists. His statements obviously sparked concerns about potential violence from his followers, reminiscent of the January 6th Capitol riot. This conviction, tied to hush money payments, is one of several serious legal challenges he faces, including cases on election interference and handling classified documents. As Trump continues to rally his base, the political climate remains highly charged and anxious. So, do you see these? Did you see this video, this black and white video you put out on all sorts? I mean, it is genuinely quite frightening, the sort of the rhetoric that it's pushing to push to his supporters, isn't it? Do you think we're going to see some backlash from this?
Well, I mean, you have the Capitol riots, you know, not that long ago. And the problem is that America is the USA, but what people forget is it's a really, really young country. Like in the UK, where we've got like 1,000 years of mostly cohesive history, the USA has been around for what, you know, 250 maybe? And so you have this society of just, at the moment, the Democrats and the Republicans, people just breaking down sectarian lines. And it's, I don't know, I think it could be really bad. But the problem is with Trump, you know, what he did, the big thing he did was lie about, you know, the hush money. No one really cares about his moral. People aren't voting him because he's a moral, ethical person. People vote for him because of his policies, and people agree with his policy statements.
Yeah.
Had he just been honest and said, yeah, I paid some hush money, what are you going to do about it? I suspect that it would have just died down and been a nothing burger. But because he lied and obviously lied, any jury would have, you know, looked at that and gone, yeah, obviously he's lying. And now he's found guilty. Is he going to see the inside of a jail? Probably not, I would guess. But, you know, the thing is, if he does go to jail, it'll be the best thing for his campaign ever. Like, it'll be the best.
Yeah, exactly. It's like the mugshot again. I mean, did you see that? You know, we mentioned the media was basically told not to identify any members of the jury. Such was the concern, obviously, that they'd be threatened or intimidated. But as you're talking about the sentencing, which is going to take place on the 11th of July, which is, I think, 3 days before the start of the national convention, but he could still become US president, even as a felon in the elections, even if he's jailed. I mean, as you say, that would be the best poster shot ever.
Well, the other thing is that I know British, UK, English and Welsh law is what I'm good at. I'm not great with American law, but my understanding is it's going to be a federal crime he's committed. And if he becomes president, the president has the power to pardon federal crimes. So, the election's in November, isn't it? So you could see him, he's been convicted, you could see him in a jail cell as early as July, become elected in November and spring himself free, believe it or not. Which is, I know you laugh, but genuinely,
it's Hollywood. It's Hollywood all over.
Obviously, you know, like having been convicted of one thing tends to be that these things snowballs and there's a lot more crimes coming down the line. But I suspect his idea is, I'll become the president for my second term. I'm 77 years old and not in particularly good health. By the time I'm out at sort of 81, 82, no one will really care. The thing is that, like, on a wider scale, I mean, America is just, I don't know if you've ever been to the States. I think one of the big things that, like, kind of the UK mind struggles to comprehend is, like, every state is its own thing. Yes, it's one country, but, like, Texas has its own culture, is the size of Spain, France, and Germany put together. You know, they're different, but some, like, Texas and California, for example, are just completely different, and like New York and Florida, just completely different places.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think you're going to get like a very difficult political divide. But then I think this is what happens in politics. You have people who are like, if you have a two-party political system, it tends to be the case that for a time both parties are really wide apart from each other, and then they come closer to the center to try and steal the center ground, and then when one loses, they move apart again. So I think you're just in that part of the cycle where they're just opposites to each other. And then you'll probably get more centralized candidates over the next few years or so. But the problem is, I suppose, that they've opened up so many cans of worms for things like Medicaid, or repealing Roe v. Wade with the, well, essentially repealing it with opening up the abortion can of worms, that you now have, you have so many divisive issues, gun control, I suppose, forever and ever, that it'll be difficult for people to find a central ground that everybody can agree on in America. Whereas those kind of like social issues largely in Europe have already been decided for a long time.
Yeah, what you've got to understand about the United States of America as it stands at the minute, it is just in the same way as different empires were no longer the main empire in the world. There is a changing of the guard. Just like the British Empire earlier in the 100 years ago plus was no longer the main empire in the world, the US is leaving that position over the next few decades and will be replaced by Far East and the basically the masses of people that are over there. You look at India and China, 2.6 billion, 2.7 billion people, which is like a third of the population of the entire world. And they are going to be the new empire, the new center of the world. Without
I think India, definitely. China, though, I mean, both countries, but China in particular, their issue is going to be the demographic problem on the one-child policy. So, you know, like a lot of economists, you know, I'm kind of come down in favor of this argument. They think that China is going to continue to grow for another sort of 10 years or so. And then they're going to have a huge problem because the majority of China's economic superiority is just manpower, right?
Yep.
Increasingly, it's technology and they're developing their own tech. But, you know, there's going to be a point where their population is just going to collapse. And you're seeing it in South Korea as well, Japan, definitely, Italy, and then to a lesser extent, but still pretty extreme across the rest of Western Europe, including the UK. I mean, people aren't replacing themselves at all. Whereas India, the birth rates have, you know, they've come down, but I still think that the average woman is having 3 children in India. So you're still seeing population growth. But that's a country where I would say the most growth is going to come from.
China, they're actually paying you to have more children now.
They are, well, yeah, but it's... You can, but at the end of the day, A, you've created a cultural expectation of only having one child, but B, even if you want to have more, it's all the economy, isn't it? Like, you need to be able to buy housing, you need to have jobs, you need to, and you know, like, it's very difficult to change the culture once you have it, you know? I mean, it's the same with, like, you know, I've got 3 children. I genuinely believe that if the government was more, you know, more supportive of children and families in the UK, then people would have more, but the truth is that, yes, some people don't want to have any, but many people delay them. You know, across the developed world, many people are delaying having children because they can't afford housing and they don't have stable careers. So, and that's only going to create a bigger problem the longer it goes on. What do you think, Phil?
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think we should now, we've done the politics thing, you know, and we've done that one to death. Let's just talk something that was in the news this week. Copper. Goldman Sachs predicts that surging demand for critical metals from the artificial intelligence and defense sectors will drive gold and copper prices to record highs in 2024. The investment bank's report forecasts copper prices reaching $12,000 per ton and gold prices hitting $2,700 per ounce by the year end, driven by a combination of technological advancements, geopolitical tensions, and economic factors. So firstly, I mean, I guess we saw the recent two-year high on copper, and I know both of you attended a copper-themed presentation in the city this week, courtesy of Colin Bird. What did you make of it? What was the buzz around the copper? Just talk us through the event.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I would say is that people in the room, you know, for the first time ever, already knew about the copper supply gap. So, you know, I've been to a few of these things before, and people have kind of gone, oh yeah, it's going to be a problem in the future, it's going to be a problem in the future. And the future has finally become now. And it's really fun to see it that, you know, not only is copper rising really high, but a lot of these companies are starting to follow. In terms of like the individual investment cases, obviously Extract with its $15 million of, you know, funded exploration looks, yes, wonderful. That's going to come in really well. African Pioneer, great. Galileo just got a mining license for Lanzobe, and therefore, you know, you've got a massive amount of optionality there. So, you know, and I've said it before, you know, in conversations with Colin, you know, both recorded and not, that these companies, over the past sort of 5 or 6 years, he's got some of the best licenses in Africa, you know, in the Zambia or Botswana. And he's slowly just been taking them while people weren't paying attention to copper or to, you know, these jurisdictions in general. And now it's become, you know, one of the hottest zones to get licenses in the world. And he's got some of the best of them. and the valuations of these companies are still on the floor. At some point, they're going to re-rate. And, you know, he didn't really talk so much about the portfolio, because I think the portfolio sells itself. But, you know, when he was talking about copper, you know, one of the things that struck me was that it wasn't a lot of people talk about, you know, the EVs and like electric vehicles are what gonna, you know, drive for copper demand. And actually, it's not that. It's, you know, the less developed world wanting to become developed, everybody in the world wanting a fridge, wanting a car, wanting copper piping, and all of that, you know, is gonna massively increased demand. Now, at the same time, supply is coming offline. If you see, you know, South America and FQM and their $10.3 billion investment just kind of crumbling into dust, and you're looking at the copper grades in South America and just all over the world, and they're just kind of like they're just the grades are falling, the volume of copper being mined is falling. You're seeing, you know, in this consolidation space, all the majors are desperately trying to get hold of copper deposits now. So obviously you have the Anglo-American BHP drama. BHP have walked away for now, but I'm sure they'll be back, or somebody else very soon, because Anglo's got the copper and it's very undervalued, but then Anglo wants to be paid properly for it, which is fair enough. But then obviously you had BHP buying up all the minerals recently, all the Oyu Tolgoi mine in Mongolia, and that you know, but again, you're gonna need multiple of those kind of mines, those world-class mines opening up to, for, you know, anticipated demand. And then on top of that, I mean, you had Newmont and Newcrest, and Newmont bought out Newcrest. You know, a lot of it was about the copper rather than the gold, even though that's like the underlying story. So copper is gonna go ballistic in the late 2020s now. Well, one of the key things I think is really important to understand is that there's two. The first is that at $12,000 copper, there's plenty of projects, including Bushranger, which is in the Bird portfolio, where, you know, above $10,000 copper, a lot of these projects that weren't viable suddenly become super viable. And the second thing is that the capital expenditure for like projects where, you know, you need it, it's large projects, but they're a lower grade, suddenly it becomes feasible to spend the capex if you know the copper price is going to stay high. Now, I suspect that, it might be that we see $12,000 copper, 13, 14, 15, whatever. But it's going to be very volatile over the next couple of years, because a lot of it is about funds shorting copper, or, you know, having negative positions on copper. As they close them out, there'll be squeezes up and down. But it's only going one way. The demand for the metal is only increasing, and supply is only falling. So eventually you're going to get to the situation. And you know, I feel like I'm rambling now, but everybody's been saying it. I mean, Rio Tinto have said it for years. Glencore said it for years. Trey Figura, which is the largest copper trading house in the world, they've been saying it for years. Every analyst, every CEO of every company said copper is going to be a huge problem. And now we finally got there, and you've got all these juniors, you know, not just Collins companies as well. Arc Minerals is out there as well. There's AsiaMet, there's East Star, you know, led by Alex. Golden Metal, and they've got Garfield, which is looking a bit interesting. So anybody with like a really decent early stage copper exploration project is going to do really, really well. That's my perspective over the next sort of 2 or 3 years. And that's the end of my rant.
That's the end. And you were rambling, Bill.
Well, I try not to, but you know.
I think I'll just set the timer next time. I'm going to set you a timer.
Yeah, sure. Go for it. It's all in the top of my head, you know, but this is, yeah, I did, to be fair, we went afterwards, we went out for a few drinks afterwards. You know, after you've had a couple of pints, everyone's just talking at each other for, you know, several minutes. No one's really paying attention. So maybe limit my time on a podcast.
So you got a new drinking partner in Kelby, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Kelby and a few others there. I think my favorite thing about going to London is that there's two things. The first is, I'm in Devon, so we think we can drink. And you go to London with the financial, oh my God, they can put them away. The second is just seeing people in person, you know, because I know. I'm generally just in the home office. I'm up in London, you know, once or twice a month, but often just, you know, see one or two people, see like a group of people. Yeah. And also it's really nice that most of them knew who I was, but never put a name to a face. And like vice versa, I've seen people's opinions of what they've written or whatever. And sometimes it's just amazing to click, like Oliver at Golden Metal. We only spoke for like 5-10 minutes, but I'd never seen him in person before, you know, and yet
were you blown away by how tall he was? I mean, I'm tall.
You know, I know he's tall.
Next to him. I was like, what? I was cricking my neck.
No, well, the thing is, I'm 6 foot tall, right? And he must be like, 6'3", maybe? Like, he is a...
No, I'm 6'4", 6'3", I'm 6'3", he's 6'7".
He's 6'7". I don't know. Anyway, less of Oliver's height.
Yes, indeed. It's possibly not relevant to me.
Yes, indeed. Yes, it was the first time I'd physically met you as well, Charles, so that was good. The thing that stood out to me was, yes, Colin didn't go big style, you know, this asset, the other asset that he has. But what stood out was that, yes, there is a fundamental problem with copper. There isn't enough.
Yes.
And what he didn't really realize when he was going for this was that the supply side would be so dire. And this is the issue. The other thing is, in northwest Zambia, you've got Ivanhoe Mine, with the second biggest copper mine in the world, 60 kilometers away from all of the land that African Pioneer have, Galileo have, Extract has. And Ivanhoe has jumped over that, which is one of the biggest mines in the world, and gone straight to the Angolan border and bought all the licenses on the Angolan border side. So, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to draw a line through all of these licenses and understand that there probably is a huge plate of copper underneath this. You know, geologically, maybe that's very simplistic, but I think it's not as simplistic as it sounds. I think it's almost...
It's just logical, isn't it?
It's logical. Yeah. And I think there is basically a huge plate of copper that the earth has laid down in that situation, going from that mine, which is a 5%, you know, production mine, all the way through this northwest Zambia area and into Angola. And effectively, they think it goes down into Namibia as well. But whether that actually happens or not, and anyone looks for that at this stage, I don't know. But that was the takeaway for me. And then the final sort of nail in the coffin was that if Colin's companies collectively got $200 per ton of contained copper for all of the contained copper that is within his companies, then his companies right now should have a market capitalization of $800 million. And their current market capitalization is $35 million.
Yeah.
So that said it all to me. And I'm not picking out African Pioneer, or I'm not picking out Extract or Galileo or Byzant. But, you know, the reality of the situation is nobody has quite got it, you know, and he said that in the presentation as well. They haven't got it.
Well, they've got to prove the truth machine, as they call it, has got to start turning, which I'm from what I believe from Hunter is going to happen very soon. And
no,
basically,
but Phil, that is with the truth machine. That is just what is agreed is there. Okay, so that's not anything to do with what might be there in northwest Zambia. Nothing.
Yeah, that's just on the proven chalk resources.
That's just what is there.
They've already got the resources, don't they? Like it's the thing is, you walk away from that and you just think the value disconnect is just crazy. It's just crazy. But I've always thought it's crazy.
It is mental.
Yeah, but you know, and you're coming up to this copper boom, and it's just those licenses. You know, someone's going to want them. That's the reality. Someone's going to want to buy them out from him.
Yeah,
and you know. I guess you know. Actually, the main question I got from the people after the presentation was, which one is the best? Which one should we go for? And, you know, I just said, you know what, just spread it out, go for all of them, because we don't know which one is going to blow first. Like I think there seems to be, like, everybody seems to be aware that the next kind of like the next big discovery is likely to be in Zambia or Botswana. Right, where all this exploration spend is going, it's going to be in copper. Which of these sort of four or five companies in the portfolio is going to have the asset that's going to, you know, deliver you that massive 20 times return? You don't know. You've got to go for all of them. Is there one in particular, Kev, that you like the best, or do you think you've got to scattergun it? I think you've got to go down the approach of splitting your investment.
Well, for me, just purely because the money's being spent in the ground, it's African Pioneer with First Quantum. Because, you know, if you're talking about a first, might not necessarily be the biggest in the end.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about the first, it's got to be a First Quantum African Pioneer scenario. And then secondly, if the license comes for Hokangara in Namibia, Byzant. Byzant is so lowly valued. It's got £2 million market capitalization. Hokangara will change that dynamic in a heartbeat. You know, suddenly that share should be worth the same as Galileo or Extract or whatever, which is 4 or 5 times its current market capitalization. So if you want to have a gamble on a license in the short term, then you should be buying and holding Byzant, in my view. If you want to have a gamble on what's going to be happening with the drill bit, then you should be holding African Pioneer.
Yeah.
If you want to have a gamble that copper is going to be worth 12,000 plus over the next year or two, then you should be holding Extract, because Bushranger is suddenly worth $100-200 million probably.
Monster at 10,000.
If you want a play on something that's probably going to come into production in the next 6 to 12 months at outset, the longest time, You want to be buying Galileo because you got Lewin Sobey.
Yeah.
And you've also got Shinganda, which looks extremely prospective as well. And those two companies are both cashed up. So, I mean, I've given you an argument for all four.
Yeah, I know.
Which is what you're saying.
Yeah.
If you want a short-term catalyst, in my view, it's African Pioneer and Bazant are the ones that are actually valued less than the other two at the minute, but actually could have, you know, let's put a, you know, scenario in place. Let's say First Quantum come out. First Quantum say, here's copper, we found it. It's currently running at 3-5%, and it's, we think it's a continuation of the thing. How much is African Pioneer's license worth?
Yeah, a lot. And bear in mind, I mean,
Colin, I mean, no, seriously, how much is it worth? Is it worth hundreds of millions?
Hundreds of millions. Yeah, it's possible. It sounds crazy, though. This is the thing. You sound crazy when you say it, but it is possible. And we know it's possible because Colin sold, you know, was it back in 2009?
Yeah, Calum Beta. QR mines.
Yeah. So, you know, it can be done. It has been done. The person leading the company has done it. I mean, you know, for me, I just... With Extract in particular, because, you know, you've spoken about Galileo and, you know, Lewin Sobey and African Pioneer. But with Extract, for me, that you know, that sale of Manica and that $15 million in cash in those staged payments all the way to March 2027, I really like that. I really like that because you know that you're going to have that exploration in Zambia funded for a lengthy period of time. That's something that, you know, a lot of, you know, exploratory companies, you're not sure where the money is going to come from to do the next drilling program. But with Extract, you already know for the next 3.5 years where the money's coming from. And then, you know, potentially more. And that's the other thing with Colin, you know, with Colin, this stable of companies that I really like is, you know, what have they done? Like 50,000 meters of drilling. They've done so much drilling over the past few years. So it's not like the money isn't going anywhere. It's going into the ground. And there's so, like, all of these companies have like actual JORC resources that have value already beyond what the market capitalizations already are. So all you have to do is just wait a little bit of time. The copper is going to go up. The sector is red hot. A year, 2 years from now, but potentially much, much less, there's going to be a huge return. And then the question is, which one's going to play first? And as you say, Ken, I can't choose a favorite. So, you know, I've gone down the scattergun approach. I buy, you know, an equal amount of shares in all of them. But it sounds to me that African Pioneer is closest to your heart. Maybe, maybe not. It's what it feels like.
Yeah. I just also know that it's two assets, actually. Yes, you've got Northwest Zambia, and you've also got stuff in Botswana. But the thing that we saw when we were in Namibia, and that's why it's so clear in my head, is, again, it's tied to the license in Hope and Gorup in Namibia. Because Ongombo has a mining license, okay? Ongombo is ready to be
mined.
Done, if you like. It's not ready to be mined. Let's get real. But it suddenly has a valuation, yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And if Hope and Garab comes good, then you now have two assets with the ability to have processing plant between them and, you know, a railway line straight from Ongombo to Hope and Garab and then Willows Bay or whatever, Walvis Bay, as Colin said. So you got to think how Colin is thinking as well, okay? This is a put-together plan that, you know... And it's all really waiting for Hope and Gorup. If Hope and Gorup comes good, then African Pioneer suddenly has two things that could go amazing, not just one.
Yeah.
So that would be the reason why, you know, African Pioneer at sort of £5 million market capitalization, there isn't a possibility in my view that either of those things wouldn't be sold for probably 10 times that amount, even today.
Yeah.
You know, terrible. I mean... If somebody came to Colin Bird today and offered him £50 million for his Northwest Zambia licenses, he'd probably say no.
Yeah, he would.
So, you know, what does that tell you about the current
market? You know, I was just
thinking... It's mental.
Sorry, I mean, like, I was just thinking it because I thought... I literally, for a second, I put myself in his shoes. I would say no. You know, like, it's all it is time and waiting. And obviously, if you've been a long-term investor in these shares, you are down. But, you know... Good times are coming. The COVID pillar advert. You can finally feel the sentiment. The optimism is back in the market. The copper is rising. It's a red hot jurisdiction. It's all going to come together all at the same time.
Yeah, and I would say we hold a bit of each as well. I'm not gonna say what amounts, but we hold a bit of each as well. So I'm not against what you're saying in any way, but what we've got to look at is what is going to be the catalyst. Well, the first thing has been the copper price. That catalyst is happening and will continue. And yes, as Colin said, maybe it dips, and it has dipped. It's gone by, you know, down to 4.6 per pound instead of 5.1 or whatever it was. Mm. So there has been some variation in it. But you've got to look at all of the other factors that are in play and in play right now. And the drill rig is in play with First Quantum on that license in Northwest Zambia.
Yeah.
And supposedly we're waiting for signatures now for Ngarab. You know, this will mean a big deal for both African Pioneer and Zap.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's get this drilling season out of the way now that it's, even though they've had not really had a rainy season, but now that we're into the dry season, then hopefully I'll get that drill bit turned, as you say. But let's have a look at Cobra Resources. Had a good RNS this week. Some of the moves and shakers. They announced reassay results from 195 samples, which is 17 drill holes at the Wadena project in South Australia, confirming the continuity and scalability of ionic rare earth mineralization at the Bolan discovery. Metallurgical testing for an in-situ recovery mining, a low-cost and low-disturbance method, is progressing with full results expected in June 2024. So what did you make of that news?
Yeah, it looks very, very interesting. Like, I think, you know, whenever you talk about, like, a rare earth deposit, if you have something good, it is extremely valuable because something good is very rare. Now, when it comes to, like, grades or metallurgy of, like, rare earth deposits, it becomes very difficult, unless you really know what you're talking about, to know whether you've got something good. But it seems that Cobra has, you know, got something that could be really promising. And at the moment, I'll be honest, I don't know enough about rare earths to comment on it and say, yes, this is definitely great. So I've outsourced that to a couple of other analysts, and I'm waiting for them to get back to me. So I can't say enough. Ask me again in a week or two and I'll have, like, an informed opinion. But sometimes it's best when you're dealing with rare earth deposits, it's really difficult to know whether what they've got is really good or not. But at the moment, the early signs look really promising.
Yeah, my view on it is it is really good. But the actual issue is not just that it's really good, it's really cost effective. Okay. The way that they're going to actually be able to get these rare earths out of the ground, literally with just water and in situ mining, is going to mean that they more than compete with the Chinese rare earths. And this is spread over a vast area, and they've only covered a certain area. It's obviously, its propensity is that it is in a small, shallow section under the earth, not very many meters down, and literally they can just in situ mine the whole stuff. So yeah. I think it's going to be one of those that, yeah, it could actually be that they take it to mining, or alternatively someone comes in and offers them. Again, we're talking about big numbers again, about like a huge amount of money for it. Now, interesting thing about a Cobra is that Cobra has a gold asset with a JORC report on it, which is probably now, with the price of gold, worth more than its current market capitalization. So if you look at Cobra, the actual gold, I think, is worth more than the market cap. And yet nobody's talking about the gold because it's just been put on the back burner, because this is a lot more exciting at the minute in terms of the rare earths. So that's my take on that. And I think it's one of those that you're going to see. It'll be 2p, it'll be 3p, it'll be 4p, it'll be 5p before you know it.
Well, it's moved a lot. And I nearly just fell off the chair, lads. And I've been away this last week. I've just looked at some of the stock movers this week. I mean, GPL as McGrath Polymer has moved 860%. That's by far the biggest performer. I don't really know much behind that. But the other ones I've seen, like GMET, is up at 21.5p. It was 16 pence before I left the UK. What's happened there?
I think you need to leave the UK more often, fellas. But what's happened there? I mean, well, you know, I did an article on GMET recently. Essentially, there was a leak of a slide of proposed grant funding, but essentially from the US government. And while it hasn't been awarded, it is in the pipeline. And then because there was initially a leak, the Department of Defense had to put out like the official presentation. And it's there in black and white, Pilot Mountain, Nevada, US. It's in the pipeline. The grant funding hasn't been granted yet, but, you know, everything that's been in the pipeline so far has been rubber stamped through, and the question is, how much is the grant funding going to be? Probably going to come through in Q4. And therefore, you've got a lot of investors who are now really interested in it. And I think, interestingly, GMET's also listed, you know, over the counter in the US, and there's been a lot of activity there as well. So I think it's taken hold of investor hearts, not just in the UK, but also across the Atlantic.
Yeah. That's a nice surprise to look at on SharePad. I mean, there's been a few others as well. Genflow's up about 35%. I think they got a European grant again. They seem to be getting these grants coming through very frequently. Prospects is up 30% on the week as well. They had an RNS, didn't they, about that.
But, well, I don't know. The Prospects, I mean, like I said at the start of this year that's a company that I think they're going to get bought out in 2024. And it's kind of simple that their warrants now, there's no warrants, there's no debt, they're revenue producing, they're permitting things in Italy and, you know, for the extra wealth in Italy and Spain are going to come through. I think give it, I don't know, a few months, maybe less, and it's just going to be taken out. And I guess the only question is, because the thing is, Prospects aren't going to be able to drill all these wells by themselves. And no, people don't want a joint venture. They're going to want it for themselves. And the question is, what are you going to get per share? And I'm thinking somewhere between 15 and 20p. I know others want more. Potentially, they might hold out for more. And obviously, if you have shares and the offer comes through, then obviously you vote for what you think is best. But having said that, I think that it you know, obviously there's been a rise, there may be profit taking, but I look at it and I go, you know, it's just fundamentally undervalued for what they have. Mm. And somebody else, the National Grid connections are so valuable that somebody else, a bigger operator with deeper pockets, given the changing regulatory environment in Italy as well, it's so much more positive than it was even 6 months ago. And somebody is just going to come out and take them out. I think that's what's going to, I think everyone, it's kind of like an open secret on the market. Yeah, I mean, what do you think? Do you think that's a possibility? I think with Prospects, it kind of must be. Is it? Well, I don't know. Maybe not must be, but I think it's a good chance.
Yeah, Prospects Energy is not. It's an investment club, if you like. So will they be completely taken out, or will they just sell some of the assets? I don't know. I think it's very likely, because the potential size of what they have and the percentages of what they have, they're not controlling percentages in most situations. So yes, it's very likely that they will be bought out partly or all of
Italy or Spain.
So it's a definite possibility, and who knows. I mean, it's obviously, it's one of our stocks of 2024, so we perceive that it's going to be much the same as yourself. It hit a high of nearly 20p over, what, a year, 18 months ago?
Yeah.
When everyone was getting super excited because gas prices were crazy sky high. Gas prices have started to climb a little bit. I don't think we're going to see the same hysteria. But, you know, even at this level, they're making good profits, so it should do well.
Well, I think it's also about security of supply. Obviously, realistically, compared to national demand, it's not that much. But it is European-based gas, right? I think this is what, obviously, they're selling the gas from Italy at a premium to, you know, spot prices. But it's also about security of supply. If you're an operator, you know, we live in a really tense world geopolitically. And if you own assets in like Italy or Spain, and you're supplying Europe through grid connections, then that's incredibly valuable, you know, in and of itself. I don't think they'll be on the market at 12 months from now. But again, I don't know, but I just think the potential that they have in Spain and Italy is beyond what they'll be able to do by themselves. And a joint venture operator, I know you've got Po Valley with Acelva, but they may just want to just take it out. And you've got to bear in mind, in Spain,
Tesorillo looks fantastic if that's those licenses are granted.
But I mean, it's you know, obviously they're in the, it's Warrego, isn't it, that owns like the 85%. And Warrego is 100%, it's a subsidiary of Hancock Energy. And Hancock obviously is you know, a massive, massive player. So, yeah, I mean, all of that's going to come possibly all at the same time, and then you're going to see fireworks. But again, it's exactly this. It was great value a few months ago. You know, anyone, you know, who'd done the research could see that, and now you're reaping the rewards. It's quite enjoyable to watch the market go up for once.
Absolutely. Sovereign Metals as well. I see that one's moved up some circa 18 to 20% on the week as well. What's going on? What do you make of that move?
Well, I think, you know, I highlighted it when we interviewed Sapan back in, December last year, when it was like 21p. And obviously it's up to like 32 or 33 or something at the moment. So we've had a really good run, but it's only going to continue rising. And I think basically, as you know, Rio Tinto is a 15% shareholder. They're sharing their operational expertise. It's the largest rutile deposit in the world, the second largest graphite deposit in the world. And they're still drilling it, and they're still expanding what they're doing. There's sort of like plans for all sorts of testing and, you know, sampling and whatever else. But at the end of the day, people are now starting to realize that there is like a critical mineral shortage. And these companies with like a unique investment case, right? And you can say gold metal with their tungsten deposit, or sovereign with their titanium deposit, where they're kind of irreplaceable. Rio Tinto is the largest, you know, titanium trader in the world. They're a 15% shareholder. They will buy this asset. I mean, I'm not 100% confident. You never say 100%, but I'm very confident that they're going to want to buy it at a significant premium. And people have just woken up to that valuation gap. It's as simple as that. But then on top of that, obviously, there's all that, again, geopolitical uncertainty when it comes to things like titanium. You know, if you're in like the USA or Europe, for example, your titanium comes from, you know, Japan. But then Japan is already at max capacity for its exports. And then China, obviously. And again, you know, China imposes a titanium or slash tungsten export ban. How much more valuable does, you know, golden metal tungsten or sovereign metals titanium become when it's not, suddenly it's not about pricing, it's about security of supply? Tungsten and titanium are both elements which are absolutely essential in defense applications. You can't live without them. You can't replace them with anything else. And yes, yeah, so sovereign's just flying because the wider macro environment is just far better than what it used to be. And also, I guess, marketing as well. You know, I don't want to go like toot our own horns, but I think up until, you know, a lot of people have never heard of the company before, and now it's become more of a household name, which is nice to see because they deserve it.
Yeah. Sovereign looks very, very good. I mean, I don't like to say we told you so, but we told you so, you know, over the last...
It's nice. It's nice to say it. We can say it. We told you so. Oh, Sovereign Metals.
You know, but over the last number of months. And yeah, these things have still only just begun, okay? So don't think I've missed the boat. Yeah, I've missed the boat. It's the same with GMET. I mean, we're in the same situation with GMET. We picked GMET at 9.25p. Yeah. I was buying GMET at 7p or whatever.
Me too. I was telling everyone to buy it. No one listened.
Okay. And yes, the story has been perfect almost, hasn't it? I mean, it's just gone wrong so far. But now there is a situation where there are buyers on the market. Okay, it's a, if you wanna just think about this as a company that is on the market, and you want to know what the market mechanics are, people are trying to buy in, and what happens when everybody wants to try and buy in and nobody wants to sell because they see the story is 50p a pound, whatever it happens to be, then the price just slowly starts to gear up, and that's what's happening. And we're only
beautiful to watch it. Do you know, like because you know, Pametal owns 50% of the stock, and they will never sell their golden goose that proves the business model. That's not going to happen, at least until it's, you know, far, far higher. And then you've got high net worth investors and supportive investors owning up sort of 25%. So only, you know, 20-25% of the shares are actively free floating. You know, you've got people like me. You know, I don't have a massive holding, but I have a decent holding in golden metal. I'm not selling my shares. They have a golden ticket. Yep. This isn't going to happen again. It's the largest undeveloped tungsten deposit in the United States. It's at this perfect storm where tungsten is needed. The US needs it. You're going to get the grant funding most likely. They're going to keep drilling and expanding the resource. You've got these new applications. You have the necessity that it's needed for defense. You've got these Sino-US tensions. It's never going to happen again. So this is a stock where if you're a holder, you're going to hold it because you're going to milk it for money, right? That's the reality. You're going to, this could be one of your big profit makers over the years. If you're in it sort of, well, I think my average is like 7.9p. But, you know, if you're in it 10p, 15p, well, Oliver was buying on the market. It was 10p a share. Was it back in January? Or maybe a little bit earlier, you know, and people were going
9 point something or 10.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, people were going, oh, my God, he's buying at the top. Why is he buying? Well, a CEO buying at the top. And if that wasn't enough for you to realize what was about to happen, you know, you've had a slide from the Department of Defense. They've published it. You know, it's on my site, FTSEAIM.co.uk. But, you know, you can find it on the defense. You know, if you want to go look for it, it's there. It's in the pipeline. So we know that, you know, grant funding is almost certainly going to come. And the only question is, how many millions of dollars are they going to get?
and Sovereign Metals is in the same boat.
Yeah, okay, you've got Sapan
there sitting there saying, guys, and he's trying to tell everybody as much as possible.
Listen to you two. You're well buzzing. You're buzzing on it, aren't you?
We're buzzing, you know. Sorry for the friend. I'm sorry, but we've had a couple of, like, at least 2 years where the market has been a bit terrible. And now all of that conviction when you've been positioning at the bottom is paying off. And it feels so, so good. It's so good to just watch it go, right, yes, we told you so. And I guarantee, you know, I can't guarantee because we're in the high risk sector of the market. But, you know, going back to Colin's portfolio, those four or five companies, they will go higher. And a year from now, I reckon we're going to be having this same conversation going, oh, we told you so about those ones. And they're all cheap at the moment. And they won't be for long.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. I agree with you. And not just because this is how we've sort of, I mean, what I've seen in our 12 stocks of 2024 is that 6 weeks ago, we were 8 or 9% down across the portfolio. Now we're 3% up in just a few weeks.
Yeah.
And that is only going to keep moving the right way as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. So guys, I was just looking at some of the shakers and we've got to talk about the ones that drop as well. What happened at Alchemy? I saw there was a financial chairman statement, but I'm looking at it now and it's down some 50% or 38% on the day on Friday's close, about 57, 58 pence. Do we know what's gone on there?
I think basically they put the RNS out last night at 4:30 with the statement of their finances, and it probably didn't look too good. It means they've got to raise some.
Yeah, I mean, I was just reading through them, but I mean, they're strategically positioned to meet that demand for those critical metals, and they were talking about these green bonds in there and how they're going to finance. But I just wondered whether, I don't know, it just seems strange that there was such a significant drop on the chairman's statement.
Yeah, I think it's just the thing. It's always been the way, which is that the potential there is really, really strong, but they need money to realize it. And yeah, I mean, obviously they put out the annual report and these financial statements, and you know, the market has effectively just said they're going to need money and they're going to need it really soon. And the only way they're going to get it is through a discounted placing. Now, whether that's fair or not, you know, I don't know. I don't know Alchemy, as in I don't know the management, and I've never spoken to them. I support them in terms of, I think what they're trying to do is great. But you need capital. It's really capital intensive, and they haven't got that together yet. So, you know, hopefully they'll manage to do it. And you know, this is the dip, which, you know, a potential opportunity. But it's exactly the same thing. The problem that they have, and it's not their fault on any level, it's just the macro environment. I mean, interest rates are still at 5.25% in the UK. So in order to like borrow money from everybody, it's just so much harder than it was a year or two ago when they were making all their plans. You might find that as the interest rates start to come down, it all becomes a lot more viable. But at the moment, it's difficult to get hold of the capital they need to get cracking. I'd say it's
and that comes back to some of the other things we've talked about today. Have Golden Metal, the resources, got cash and are going to get a grant? Tick.
Yeah.
As SVML, as Sovereign Metals, got huge amounts of cash. I've got a 15% shareholder in Rio Tinto who've got a warrant to purchase now at 30p, I think it is, at the end of this month. Tick.
Yeah.
Has African Pioneer got cash? Tick. Has Galileo got cash? Tick. Has Extract got cash?
Yeah.
Tick. Has Bizant got cash? No. But as soon as it gets its license, it's going to have cash.
So identifying the next one.
I'll correct you there a second.
Yeah.
No, right. We met the guy from Sandersons there who have been supporting Colin Bird.
Of course.
Through the different finances. And they've got money lent out to Bizant at 0.06, okay? The current price is 0.025, okay? They've got 0.06. So and they're sitting there very confident that there won't be a problem, you know, because that is still only a market cap of £4 million. So, anyway.
Okay, well, so identifying the ones that haven't reacted, I would say things like maybe Aterion need to be looked at a little bit more closely with Rio, and you know, obviously we talked about those, and also Jubilee Metals have had a good run of late. What do we make of that? There's not much value added there, really, in terms of what it should be.
Well, Jubilee, I mean, I covered it, 3 or 4 months ago, and it was like 5.5p. This is a ridiculous valuation. It should be 3 times what it is now. And Jubilee, it's not an explorer, and it doesn't make all its money from platinum, you know, and palladium, which is what it's been lumped in. It makes its money from chrome operations, which are massively profitable and rapidly growing. But it's also, you know, the Zambia copper, the various copper projects it's got going on, and then the Roan upgrade, which is going to be happening very soon. I know there was a slight delay, and which I expected, but the upgrade is going to come to Rome, and they're in the middle of a copper storm in Africa. They're going to make an absolute fortune. I you know, Jubilee, I mean, again, this is the same thing, which is when people are talking, oh, where should I start when I'm looking at kind of like investing in mining in Africa? I think Jubilee is probably the best one to start with, simply because it's large, you know, it's profitable, it's ongoing, it's really well established, and it's easy to kind of like ease your way into it before you go with, you know, maybe the higher risk explorers.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
Yeah, you know, like I think once you've been in this space for quite a long time, you know, for a few years at least, you think nothing of spending 10, 15 grand into like a small little explorer and you know, and crossing your fingers and hoping, you know, often they're the element of luck. Somebody who's coming from like a blue chip space where everything is really highly regulated and they're thinking, right, I'll get my guaranteed 10% a year. It's kind of a bit of a whirlwind. So Jubilee is kind of like that transition stock that should be, you know, core to your portfolio before you start to branch out.
Yeah, I agree 100%. I mean, basically what you're looking at with Jubilee is it should be moving forward with the Zambia expansion into copper over the next 1, 2, 3 years. You are going to get basically a call option to copper only, yeah, only on drugs.
Steroids,
You're basically, you know, Jubilee, I said it and everyone said, and there he goes again, it's going to be £1 billion company, okay? Yeah. It already is a £200 million company, but I believe that Jubilee Metals is going to be £1 billion company. In fact, it's £237 million company at the moment. Will it be four times that in the next 2 years? What possible. Do you think?
It's possible. I mean, like,
I think the copper production increase, it's probable. It's not possible.
Right, well, I mean, it really is. All down to copper pricing. Again, like we've seen it over the years where like 2008, there's a big drop off. Like, you know, it's all down to profitability because a lot of these mines go into care and maintenance when there's no pro. You know, we've seen it happen before. Yeah. So the risk is there, but it just feels this time with, as mentioned to the Goldman Sachs report, that copper is very much here to stay and the demand is so much and there's such little supply of it to meet that demand.
Well, I mean, on the flip side, I mean, that presents opportunities as well. Like, obviously, you've got Roan and Sable. I don't think the company's announced anything official yet, but obviously there's media reports about Jubilee potentially buying out Changbishi, which is, you know, ready to go. It's been in care and maintenance copper plant. No one can afford to buy it and run it, but Jubilee's got the capital to do it. So they can, you know, there's huge expansion options as well because of, you know, operations have had to, you know, shut down because of cyclical pressures. It's the same with, you know, International Resources Holding, IRH, if you know Abu Dhabi, like they're a big player and they've got a joint venture to process these waste dumps. I mean, again, those alone have millions and millions. But 350 million tons of copper waste rock assets at grades higher than 1.5%. I mean, you just dump down the modular plants and, you know, you're effectively printing money. And again, you know, like, I think it's really worth pointing out because like we talk about so many different companies of different market capitalizations. Jubilee is not a minnow. It's a 240 million market cap. It should be higher now, but it is highly capitalized. It has a lot of money. So yeah, I think they're on to a winner. I think the share price, it'll be the same thing. I think it could be double, possibly more by this time next year.
So the other two that we will ask your opinion on is Power Metal Resources and East Star Resources. What do you think?
So obviously I'll start with East Star. I think East Star is, obviously they've had a really great run, haven't they? They've gone like 150% or so over the past few months. I think that Alex is the CEO of East Star, and I think that he caught quite a bit of flack for his strategy and the way he runs things. And now everything's going gravy. And I think potentially he deserves maybe an apology. People are going, actually, he does know what he's doing. Everything's fine. Obviously, the BHP Explore Grant, the assets that they have over there in Calix, they've got a significant potential to do really, really well. I would say, I guess maybe it's not a problem, but my perspective is that because it's in Kazakhstan, it's just a jurisdiction that people don't know in the UK. If you find a deposit in Nevada in the US, for example, or in Pilbara in Australia, or the Athabasca, for example, or Ontario in Canada, or Zambia or Botswana, these are all places that people understand everything about. Whereas with Kazakhstan, you know, like people don't know it. There's not other companies in Kazakhstan that you can compare to. So it's a harder company to market and to understand. Would you say that's fair, Kev?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely off risk because of Kazakhstan. Yeah. I mean, I was one of Alex's, you know, I was criticizing him because he raised far too low. I know from speaking to him that that wasn't particularly his fault in the end, but the fact of the matter was it still had to happen. So if he hadn't raised so low, we'd still be higher than we are now. I think we hit over 4p at one point. It's now at 3.5p. And I say we because I'm a shareholder, unless it's one of the ones I really did think was going to do very well. Now, they have been touting that they're going to be selling the VMS scenario there in Kazakhstan and moving on to the porphyries themselves with BHP, which is, I hope, what happens. Now, if you have a VMS project in one of the lowest mining cost jurisdictions in the world and the world needs copper, how much is that project currently worth? Well, we're about to find out, I think, is the reality. As it stands, I don't know what East Star is currently worth in terms of market cap.
So there is a maiden inferred resource of 20.3 million tons of ore at 1.16% copper and some zinc in there as well. So do you think that that would be worth 7.9 million pounds sterling? Don't think so, somehow. Would be equivalent to 135,000 tons of contained copper with a current market value of in excess of $2 billion. And obviously it's not that profitable, but yeah, quite a proposition there.
Okay, well, Power Metals, you mentioned that one because there was a good, I saw Paul tweeting out on that this week, Paul Johnson talking about the valuation. I don't know if you saw it, you probably saw it, Charles. Yeah, he was talking about the GMET price, but that was back at 18.5. And basically, he said that 7.8 million is only the interests that are they have an FCM, the ion battery 100%. And then you just look at it and you just say, how on earth can it only be worth 7.8 million with all those other different holdings? It just doesn't add up.
It's just so beautiful. I quite like it, though, because if you're trying to build a position in gold and metal or power metal, often it's the case that you can't get hold of one or the other because people aren't selling. So it does mean that, you know, if you want gold and metal shares, you know, here's a free share tip. If you want gold and metal shares and you're struggling to buy them now, you might find that getting power metal shares that owns 50% of gold and metal shares is easier, and you're getting a lot of other stuff on the side for free. I don't know why it said that. I thought it would rise ages ago. I mean, I put out a, you know, an FCA regulated note, you know, last year with a 3.3p price target, and that was, you know, pre-consolidation, but that would be at 4.5p now. And the GSA acquisition and what they're doing in Saudi Arabia, the fact they've managed to raise money at a premium relatively recently, unlike almost anyone else in the market, and then you've got Sean leading it as well, and all of those assets. I mean, you say GMED, obviously, but the Uranium Energy Exploration IPO, that is, you know, I know it's been delayed, but it's been delayed for positive reasons. I think that's uranium is red hot. That's going to be a very good IPO. FDR will come after. What's going on in Saudi? I don't know why it's so low. I suspect what it is that it's going to be a lot of very good RNSs all in a row. I think I'm hoping that Sean is lining up kind of like, because I know he plays golf, so in my mind he's sort of like putting all the golf balls on the tees one after the other, and I'm hoping that he's just going to shoot 10 in a row, day after day.
The reality of the situation is right now Power Metal Resources has the same market capitalization as GMET.
I think gold and metal will overtake power metal. I think it's doable, and people say it's madness. Like, I've worked with Tech Capital before and their portfolio companies. And tech, you know, like, for example, they own the majority of Microsoft, and Microsoft's been worth way more than Tech Capital before. So you might find, because I know Oliver, CEO at Gold Metal, and Sean Wade, they, you know, they work in the same office together, obviously, a lot of the time. So you can imagine slowly but surely, Gold Metal becomes more and more and more valuable. The valuation gap just becomes bigger and bigger between gold and power. But eventually those valuation gaps always, always close. The fundamentals always play out. So I think what you might find
but
is,
I think you can see in the future, if that happens, then Power are going to find an institutional investor to take off 10-15% of GMET. They're going to have a huge amount of war chest cash to progress all of their
everything
in a much better way. And if that happens, then that is going to be, you know, Power Metal's going to be on steroids again.
Because you're going to both get the capital, and again, really critical, they're going to have to do it with an institutional or a very, you know, ultra high net worth investor who can do it off market. Like, this is really important, and Power will make sure that happens. They're not going to sell it on the market.
There'll be a queue of people.
Sure. Oh, they will. But the really important thing is it proves the business model to the UK investor. Now, this kind of Power Metal, this like merchant bank / massive land holding model that they have, it's really popular in the United States and quite popular in Australia. We don't really have it in the UK. It's the first time, really, that it's been tried, you know, where you spin off some assets and do an IPO and spin off the next one. If you can say, right, we spun off Golden Metal and we IPO'd, it was 10p a share. I know it dipped to sort of 7-ish p, and now, you know, it's up 150% in a year and it's only rising. The next time we do an IPO, you know, for example, Uranium Energy Exploration IPO, the marketing behind that will be, yes, uranium, yes, Athabasca, yes, they're looking promising. But look what happened with the last IPO we did, right? Yeah. The way you
Golden Metal was about 8p, by the way, it wasn't 10.
Well, the IPO?
Yeah.
Well, okay, apologies. That's my mind losing my mind. But it's okay, because are they the highest riser on the resource board today? They must be close to it. I mean, what? Yeah, yeah. Even as we're talking, they're going up.
Yeah, 21 and a half,
yeah.
Tell me about Energy Pathways, Phil. What's that done this week? Because that's actually really started.
Yeah, I think I was just looking at that. That's up to about 2.45 last time I checked. And then but that's like still below the IPO. Was it about 3p or something, the IPO?
4p.
Was it 4? Yeah. Well, there you go. I mean, I'm not going to get excited, to be honest, but it's good to see it moving in the right direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, they've got what everybody needs in the UK. They've got gas in the North Sea, just off the coast, you know, and yet people aren't getting excited about it. I don't really understand why.
Yeah, no, I just think that, you know, there was a lot of hope that this new government would, you know, get rid of the windfall tax, or at least like reduce it slightly. And now they've come out and said that they want to keep the taxation system as it is. And that just might be it, that people were previously hoping that, you know, but it's not just them, it's just dozens of operators in the North Sea are just struggling with it. But it is now moving in the right direction. So hopefully we're going to get some great news soon. There was a company update on the 16th of May. And, you know, again, solid progress on the Marram Energy storage project, fully appraised, ready to go, low cost development. So yeah, I think potentially people looked at that update, you know, and certain people just went, right, this is the time to buy shares on the dip and just hold them for a couple of years and hope that it all works out.
Yeah. Sorry, I think I said the North Sea there. It's the Irish Sea, isn't it?
Irish Sea. Yeah. Apologies.
Did you see? Well, no, I just wanted to just a quick shout out to Encantera, because they were shortlisted for Aquis Company of the Year 2024 with the likes of Solnox and One Healthcare as well. So I think the announcement is, or the awards dinner is on something like the middle of June. So just watch out for that one. It'd be interesting to see who wins the Aquis Company here.
Very good.
Should be very, very good this year as well in Encantera.
Encantera.
I mean, it is not one that, but we tipped it in a 5 gold rings. It's already double bagged. It's a 19-20p now. We tipped it at 6.5p, I think it was, at Christmas. So I hope you bought some.
Okay, I think we should wrap up there, guys. We've talked long enough. Anything else you want to mention?
No, just that the market is back and everyone seems to be happy again, which is quite wonderful to see.
Very good. Okay, if you like what you heard, please hit the subscribe button and also the like button at the bell icon for any future notifications, any future episodes. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.